Hello, this is Chris Claremont speaking to you from behind the panels. Hope you enjoy the listen, and hope you enjoy the books you're reading.
They can be a great people color if they wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, this reason, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
And welcome to issue 65 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that spends its weekends hanging around with Green Arrow and Altair. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm David McVeigh.
In this issue, we report back on Oz Comic Con Melbourne and our chats with Bill Farmer and Phil Jimenez. Then we bring you some extraordinary television news and look at the Harvey Award nominations. Plus our kick-ass picks of the week, a Chris Claremont 82 double of Wolverine with Frank Miller, and bonus book X-Men, God Loves, Man Kills, with very special guest, kind of, writer Chris Claremont himself. This is Behind the Panels.
Been stuck in X-Men world for some time now.
this actually feels quite weird because we haven't been in the studio for about 3 weeks.
I know, it's kind of like a coming home party, really.
We went to Supernova and you didn't notice much of a difference, audience peoples, because we put out a Supernova special
and we put out an interview,
and then I was off in Oz Comic Con in Melbourne for for the last week, and we took a week off because we have been all over the place. So this is us triumphantly returning to the Kingsgrove studio, David.
Absolutely, and it's nice to be here with the nice mics and the cozy little environment, which gets very hot in summer, but it's okay at the moment. And I'm kind of jazzed about tonight's show.
Yeah, look, we say kind of Chris Claremont's involved, but this is something a little bit different what we're doing this time around, because we did the great second interview with Chris Claremont. So we thought rather than just us talking at you, we'd play the relevant bits of the Chris Claremont interview, because we did it on the floor at Supernova and it wasn't quite the quality we're used to for putting out as a separate interview, but it was perfect stuff for this episode this week. Very, very excited to be bringing you that. But before we do that, I think it's time that we hit up the Wayback Machine, because we are in 1982 this week.
That's true.
So I'm going to take us back to 1982 for a little bit of this work.
It was then I felt a powerful brain seeking me out, probing my mind from far away. It was the brain of Professor Xavier, the greatest telepathic mutant on Earth. He called to me, and I came. There at his school, in his famous danger room, I met the high-flying angel. And that super acrobat, the ape-like beast. And Marvel Girl, with her fantastic power of mind over matter. And of course, Cyclops, with his devastating eye blaster.
To act for the good of mankind. You are the X-Men. Your mutant powers are triggered by your thoughts. Please think wisely.
Please think wisely, David.
There was a little bit of a double entendre near the beginning of that.
He called to me, so I came. Is that the one you were thinking of, David?
Yeah, I wasn't going to go back and reiterate it, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, I thought of that too, and I've pulled that out separately, and I won't play that. I haven't got it on the soundboard this week, but that will be making a return.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
That was from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, an episode called The Origin of Iceman.
Uh-huh.
1982.
Does he get shrinkage, do you think?
That's his origin story.
I mean, he's sticking with it.
Oh, yeah. David, I think we've got a big show lined up, so let's not waste any time getting into the segment I like to call Read Between the Lines, Bitch.
Well, looks like we got ourselves a reader. Read Between the Lines, Bitch.
So we're officially not doing what we've been reading.
Well, that, of course, signals that it's time for what we've been reading and what we've been watching. I would be very remiss if I didn't give a quick report on Oz Comic Con
Melbourne.
Yeah,
this is the one I didn't get to go to, so...
Look, I went down there for the first time. I missed it last year. And that reference I made at the start to hanging out with Green Arrow and Altair was hanging out with our very good friend and listener, John D, who was once again wearing his Green Arrow Smallville outfit. And
which is pretty good.
It's a damn good thing. He's made a few improvements since we first saw it, and he was also hanging out with another friend of his who was wearing Altair from Assassin's Creed, which is really good. If you haven't seen those outfits, have a look at the cosplay photos we put up on behindthepanels.net. Really, really good stuff. But the con itself was wonderful, and I wanted to take the opportunity to really thank the organisers. I want to really thank Blue Planet PR, who really got us some great interviews, and I'll play some clips in just a second. Mm-hmm. And just the whole organisation of it, the whole vibe, the whole feel. Apparently 33,000 people went through the Royal Exhibition Hall in Melbourne. You wouldn't notice. Like, it was it was that well organised that... it felt like a big community
It's
event.
A bit of a far cry from the organization of Supernova.
Yeah, so. Look, I mean, that was like, you know, you were crushed like sardines in a can there. This, you felt like it was a community event, which is exactly what it was. In fact, William Shatner at his panel down there, and I saw William Shatner, I saw Ron Perlman, I saw J. August Richards, I saw Jeffrey Combs at their panels. But I think William Shatner said it best. He said, "I thought people came here to see me, but in fact, they came to see each other." And it really is. That's why people go to cons, but they're there to have a bit of community, you know, and it's geeks, nerds of a feather do flock together, and we do it really well.
Next year, we're actually talking about it before the show. Next year, we're actually going to set up a donations page, and next year, we're going to try and do a con crawl. I think what we're going to do is we're going to try and actually make our way around the country and actually record shows from the con floor.
I think it'd be fabulous. And we want to say we're proud supporters of Oz Comic Con. Mm. They have been very, very good to us, including these two interviews that I did the day before the con. They were kind enough to let me sit down and chat with Bill Farmer, who's been the voice of Goofy for over 27 years, and Phil Jimenez, who you'll know his artwork from things like Wonder Woman he did for 3 years, his own creator-owned series called Otherworld. He did Infinite Crisis, and more recently he did Fairest. I'll play a little bit from, just a brief snippet from Bill Farmer first, because he worked on characters that I'm quite fond of.
Yes.
Let's see if you can work it out.
I remember doing Sam and Max was about, which had tremendous writing in it, one of the best games I've ever done. I sat in a little booth with a microphone, and it wasn't even a good studio. It was just us just on a wooden chair with a microphone about here and a big folder of lines. And, you know, that's a completely unusable thingamabob, you know, this kind of thing. And just doing over and over and over again for days on end to into a laptop. And they didn't even have a studio for that because they just did it into a laptop, recorded it right there, took it back to LucasArts and came out with a game.
Sounds a bit like our studio.
Yeah, and what a marvelous game it was. I mean, he was the original voice of Sam. And to me, he and the person who did Max, and I've forgotten his name, the definitive versions of Sam and Max.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did our Sam and Max special all those issues ago, I actually played a clip from the game, which was the two of them interacting at the start.
And when we did our Sam and Max special, don't we really wish we had this?
Hello, this is your old friend Sam from Sam and Max, and you're listening to Behind the Panels. Listen to it.
Now, how good would that have been to have had when we did Sam and Max?
But we look, that's, we're going to have to do it again just to do that.
Just be prepared. You'll be hearing that again.
Oh, yeah. The other interview I did was, as I said, with Phil Jimenez. And I asked, it's a That whole interview is now up on the podcast feed, and it's also up on behindthepanels.net under interviews, of course. He had a lot of great things to say. It is a marvelous interview because he's such a great talker. Mm. I wanted to play this clip in particular because he talks about the representation of gay characters in mainstream comics. Phil himself is gay. He came out about 20-odd years ago, I think. He started working at DC from a very early age. And he's been involved with a number of high-profile issues over the years. So, and the recipient of a GLAAD Award. He did a lot of work on The Invisibles with Grant Morrison.
Which a lot I still of those, haven't read. I must read
No, I, nor have I, actually. But I think this one would definitely do for the future and get Dave Longo in here for that.
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely.
Our resident Grant Morrison scholar. but this was a great interview. He listened to the whole thing as he talks about Grant Morrison, but this quote in particular I really loved.
Any sort of representation, positive representation, I think is good. I do tend to think that mainstream comics, particularly mainstream superhero comics, are still a fairly conservative... not only business, but present a fairly conservative view of the world, i.e. sort of men as sort of strong alphas who are out to sort of protect the world. And even the characters represented, you'll notice in Marvel, DC, and Archie, the leads are all white men, the boyfriend's husbands are all men of color, the leads all have, are sort of like, you know, super powerful, very alpha. They're a very specific kind of man, a very specific kind of male that is still consumable by straight guys, basically. To me, what will really sort of sound the siren call of change is when it's two minority characters, for example, who are the lead couple, or when it's the minority character that has the power and the white guy just happens to be his boyfriend or husband. Finally on that, also, I think sex is very interesting. When you marry off characters so quickly, on paper, you neuter them. You're no longer worried about them dating. So you no longer have love triangles. You no longer have to worry about, you know, with Archie, you have Betty or Veronica, and you always have sexual tension. But once you marry off characters, you eliminate sexual tension, gay or straight. So when we have a gay Tony Stark, for example, or a gay, ostensibly Bruce Wayne, like Playboy, who has an active sex life, who isn't married off like that, I think then, like, that will be some real boundary pushing.
Two things about that. First of all, he raises some amazing points.
Yes.
And secondly, does he breathe?
No, he's a hell of a talker, Phil. Yeah. Lovely, lovely man. He was kind enough, because we actually had some time to hang out afterwards, after the interview. Because the next interview was late. So I actually spent another 20 minutes talking to him after
that.
So he was wonderful. He took some photos with me. That's photos on the site as well. He was talking about, in the chatter afterwards, he was talking about how, we're talking about cosplay culture in Australia. He was talking about how someone dared him to go as Cosmic Boy, you know, in that really revealing tunic, you know, to a con and stuff. He's just a fantastic guy. And, you know, listen to the whole interview, check out his stuff. I don't have enough nice things to say about it.
Yeah, it's a great interview, and congratulations for that one, because it was really good.
Thank you. Look, I had a ball down there. I just want to say, really got some great photos. All of those are up on the site. I just enjoyed hanging out at that con, and I'm really the really big news about Oz Comic Con, of course, is that it's coming to Sydney next year.
Yes!
They've expanded to Sydney and Brisbane, so in September next year, I think it's the 13th, 14th, around that weekend, it'll be in Sydney. So hometown Oz Comic Con, here we come.
But we're going to do all the rest of them first.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the next Oz Comic Con you have to worry about is, I think, Perth and Adelaide in March, April next year.
Okay. So we're going to plan all this out. We're going to work it out on the calendar. We're going to work out all the dates. We're going to put it all up on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll set up a donations page for it. And you can help support us do our the Con Crawl of 2014.
In fact, that's what we'll call it, Con Crawl 2014.
Absolutely. We'll call it the Comic Con Crawl, because we'll just do the Comic Cons.
Yeah.
We'll just make our way around all of the Comic Cons.
I'm excited already, David. is there anything you want to talk about? Because I think we should probably briefly mention the kickoff of Justice League Trinity War.
Absolutely. And I read the Pandora issue, which was kind of the prelude to it. And I did read Justice League 22, I believe.
Yes,
it
that's
is,
the
which
first
is the
one.
Start one.
And by the time this show comes out, JLA 6, I think, will be part 2.
Yeah.
So.
And it was actually pretty good.
Yeah, look, I've been so surprised by this.
Yeah,
thing.
So was I. I was really going, oh, here we go, blah, blah, blah. And when I read Pandora, even Pandora didn't set me on fire.
Mm, but. Mm.
Justice League 22 was like,
I'm going to break out tag and just go, there was a holy shit moment.
Yeah,
in
pretty
that
much.
Throughout that,
yeah. No, there's actually two holy shit moments in that. And if you've lost touch with Justice League, now's time to jump back on board. This is going to be an event and a half if they don't blow it. Yeah. Now, with these sort of things, Age of Ultron came in strong and it blew it. And so you look at it and you go, if they don't blow it, this could be the event of the year.
The difference here is that Justice League is being done completely in continuity.
Yeah.
And it's being done within the Justice League book. So whatever the ramifications are of this, they are there to stay.
Although it is Pandora and she has shifted time before, so...
Well, she didn't shift time. She was just there, I think.
She manipulated Flash to shift time.
That's true. Yeah. She did. That's true. But look, you know...
If you don't know what we're talking about, this is Flashpoint, which has just come out as a film, or it's just about to come out as a film.
Yeah.
So you can catch up with it in that form, or you can go back and read Flashpoint.
It's actually debuting at San Diego Comic Con, but then it's officially out the week
after.
That's this weekend, isn't it?
That's this weekend. Yeah. So by the time you hear this, it's probably out.
But speaking of San Diego Comic-Con, look, for us, look, all the other stuff we've been reviewing over the last 3 weeks, hit up behindthepanels.net. Also check out comicbookroundup.com, where you can compare what critics from all over the web are saying about these comics. And that one in particular, Justice League 22, was getting some damn good reviews.
Yeah, look, and it's well worth having a look at. So if you, as I say, if you've dropped off of the DC or particular Justice League bandwagon, time to jump back on, just have a look at this. Even if you don't go back and grab all the others, grab... Trinity of Sin Pandora.
Yep.
Number one.
Justice League
22, and go from there.
Yep, and that's all you need.
There's a reading list in the Pandora issue,
yes,
which gives you an outline of what there is.
And it's basically just the next 2-3 months worth of Justice League books.
That's right.
It's Pandora, it is Justice League, Justice League Dark, and Justice League of America.
Yeah, and if you don't say holy shit at least twice in that issue, then you're dead inside.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, with San Diego Comic-Con coming up, there's already a whole lot of news coming out this week. So the pre-announcements before the major, even bigger announcements that come out, I like to tease a little bit of stuff. So I think it's time, David, that I hit up the news headlines.
All right.
And speaking of Justice League, Justice League War will be the next DC animated original movie. It will follow Justice League The Flashpoint Paradox and be based on Geoff Johns' New 52 versions of the series.
Vin Diesel has been meeting with Marvel for an undisclosed role. What could it be? Stay tuned for Comic-Con.
I say Scarlet Witch. The news that nobody...
Wouldn't he look cute?
In that little red outfit. The news that nobody expected, Alan Moore's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen gets a TV put pilot order at Fox. Basically, that means that it will go to air regardless.
Hopefully, it's better than the movie. Arrow Season 2 adds actress Summer Glau in a major villain role. She's best known for Firefly and Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles. Do we really have to say that?
No. Summer Glau. The other big TV show coming out is Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has a release date now. Tuesday, September 24th on Disney's ABC. Set your DVRs now. No word yet on an Australian release.
Although it has been
advertised.
2015 sometime. Yeah. DC Comics plans a new Harley Quinn ongoing series for November from the dynamic duo of Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor, and David celebrates.
I think David's doing more than celebrating right now.
David's doing a little dance chair. A chair dance. Here we go.
IDW has announced a new Star Trek Khan comic series for October, telling the origin story of the Star Trek Into Darkness version of the character.
Dynamite has got the rights to Robotech and will be releasing a crossover comic with Voltron for the latter's 30th anniversary.
Matt Fraction is bringing the Inhumans back to the Marvel Universe in a big way in December with the new series Inhumans spinning out of Infinity.
Interesting. Kick-Ass 2 director Jeff Wadlow has been tapped to direct an X-Force film, expanding Fox's X-Men cinematic universe and making sure Marvel never gets it back.
The Harvey Award nominations have been announced. Hawkeye and Saga lead the pack with 7 nominations apiece. David, let's have a look at these.
Absolutely. But look, Saga and Hawkeye, how can we go past this?
Yeah, look, I mean, they've pretty much skipped. I'm bringing the nominations up in front of us. But the difference between the Harvey Award nominations and the others, like the Eisners, for example, is that retailers... and distributors and so forth don't vote in these. This is purely selected by the creators themselves. So you could say this is the finest form of peer review.
This is kind of like, let's say, for actors, the Screen Actors Guild Award.
Yes,
or for directors, the Directors Guild Award. This is the your peers actually voting for you, not just some sort of popularity contest.
Exactly. Now, this is there's no major surprises, really, when you look at this list, which I'm bringing up on screen.
Our internet's gone really slow.
Yes.
Okay, there it is.
As I said, Hawkeye and Saga have got the most number with 7 nominations apiece. But multiple nominations went to some other obvious ones like DC's Batman, of course, Scott Snyder's thing. Daredevil, naturally. Mm-hmm. Archie from Archie Comics, which I haven't read a lot of, but it's been getting massive.
This year, the 2012-2013 season of Archie has been getting nothing but accolades.
And there's even more coming out, like Francesca Francavilla is doing Afterlife with Archie by one of the Glee creators, and it's got like most beautiful art that you're going to see on any book, let alone an Archie book.
I think we may have to revisit Archie, and we said this last time, we got burnt by Archie meets kids.
Yeah, we read some bad Archie.
But I think we need to revisit Archie. If any listener out there has a particular series that you think is the series that we should cover,
yes,
please write into us at feedback@behindthepanels.net.
Agreed. And, of course, IDW's Lock and Key is something I've been neglecting to read. I read the first issue.
I've been collecting them and still have not read them. And I know that this is a big big fan favorite of Steven Schleicher over at Major Spoilers.
Yes.
He raves about this book. And for some reason, I just haven't picked it up.
And finally, we mentioned Dave Longo before, who's been recommending Revival to us. I read the first couple of issues and it is fantastic. I've just fallen behind with it because, we read so many comics a month. That's another one that's got a lot of nominations
Let's find the first arc of that and do that as a pick.
Agreed.
And we'll get Longo on for it as well.
The first arc is out as a trade.
Okay.
Other thing I'll mention is that I want to congratulate a good friend, Jeff Lemire, who has got 2 nominations for what may be a perfect graphic novel in the underwater world.
Absolutely, which we have covered, so go back and listen to that issue.
Yeah, go back. We did that back-to-back with an interview with Jeff.
I'd like to interview him again.
I think so, because he's got a few new books out now. Mm. So, My Friend Dharma is another graphic novel. Building Stories, no surprises that got nominated. It's been getting nominations across the board. And almost all of the best cover artists are ones that you've seen in my cover story column over the last year or so.
It's amazing that we really weren't off the mark, though, is it? I mean, when you look at the stuff that we have been really plugging hard, the stuff that we've been going, this is amazing stuff, and then you look at these awards and you go, there it is. It's like they are universally acclaimed.
You go through the links on the site and you can see that I've actually linked to all the ones we've covered, and there's quite a few links in there. So
there are.
I'm pretty pleased that we're on the post.
Another Love and Rockets is also showing up again. We really have to do
Love and Rockets. Yeah, this new Love and Rockets, a couple of ones come out. And the other one by him that's come out this year is called... I've forgotten the name of it. It came out earlier this year. Names completely escaped my mind. But the author of Love and Rockets has had a few good ones. Hernandez, yeah. Has another one out this year which has been really acclaimed as well, and mine's just gone to mush at the moment, but I'm also really pleased to see that Dark Horse Presents, which is, I think, unquestionably...
Which I have been neglecting, but I should have...
Look, unquestionably the finest anthology, and the great thing about it is you can pick up any issue, because like there's a few ongoing stories in there, but every issue there's a couple of brand new stories from top flight artists and writers.
I think we may have just found our Archie book. How about Archie the Married Life book 2?
Let's do it.
Maybe we should do book one first.
I think we need to
actually set a date and do Lock and Key as well. That'll force us to read it finally.
Well, there's still a few weeks left this year, David.
Oh, yes.
So, I encourage people to go through these lists and just, if you don't know where to start, this is the perfect place.
I'm going to put money down now that says after the Harley Quinn book comes out, I'll make a bit Amanda Connor's in there for art again.
Oh, look, I if she does the art, because it doesn't specify whether she's doing
it. Yeah, but if she does the art, she'll be down there again. She does a lot of covers at the moment, though. It's unbelievable the amount of cover work she's doing. I want her to do another regular book. Amanda, are you listening?
Look, I think there's a whole lot of stuff. And also it's great that there's a separate best online comics category. Something like The Private Eye didn't make it in there because it didn't make the cutoff for this year. But obvious ones like Mike Norton's Battle Pug has been getting great acclaim, and Monkey Brain Comics, who do a lot of online stuff for Bandette, Also, Becky Cloonan, I saw turned up in there for The Mire, which is available online. That's also nominated for an Eisner. A lot of these are nominated for Eisners as well. The Eisners will be announced at the Comic-Con. So look out for those when we come back next week.
Completely non-comics related, though. I'm just looking at one of the categories here, and there's some books I want to read. Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, and Jack Kirby Collector.
That Marvel Comics, The Untold Story is meant to be magnificent.
I've got to read
I've read sections from it, and it really gives you an idea of how driven Stan Lee was and how that could often come across as being a tyrant. It's just a very different take on Uncle Stan.
Uncle Stan, okay.
But from what I understand...
But is it marvelous?
It's marvelous. From what I understand, it's the definitive history of Marvel.
I'm going to have to look at that. Also, Jack Kirby Collector sounds interesting.
And in fact, I will go you on better. I'll say, let's read that book, and at some stage in the future, we will do that as our pick.
So that would be an interesting move, a non-comic in a comics podcast.
Yeah, look, I mean, I definitely, from what I understand, as I said, definitive history of Marvel. Really look forward to reading that. But people, lists are great because they give you an indication of where to start. I don't necessarily think it's a definitive list every time, but this particular list, as we said, is a lot of stuff we've already been plugging. So go and look at the site, go and look at that list, go to the Harvey Awards site.
I'm a big fan of lists, you know that. So.
Yeah, I mean, and on that subject, we'll give a brief plug now for something that we're working on, which is a list of our favorite films.
Absolutely.
Because we will be returning to a film podcast of sorts.
Oh, my God.
let's just say it now. We'll be doing a series of specials called Film Actually 101.
People have been asking us to bring back the film show for months now. And yes, we've always been planning to bring it back. And there is actually a domain name that we purchased. And there will be a regular film show coming back. But in the meantime, we started to ponder the idea. Actually, I will say it's all Josh's amazing idea, where basically we thought, what if we talked about the films that actually motivate us, the films that make us what we compare films to? And so we look at it and go, what are our favorite films? Not what are the best films, not what are the, you know, all that sort of nonsense where they go, the masterpieces of the year. What are our favorite films? The films that we go back to over and over and over again. So we're going to do Film Actually 101. And it's going to start with a series of only 10 episodes. They're going to be nice and short. And they're going to be, each episode will be one film, and it'll be a list of films that are our favorites. And we're just going to kind of educate people on what makes us tick.
So X-Men Origins Wolverine, look out for that.
That'll be on Josh's list, right?
David, while we're in this jovial mood, let us hit up a little girl from Ipanema.
Oh, yes. I have her somewhere. I keep her in a box.
We have some feedback this week. Hey, guys. How you doing? I asked people this week on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/behindthepanels, what they would like to see. I put up a little picture from Rainbow Reading with LeVar Burton. and we had a couple of responses on that one. I should actually give a big shout out while I'm here as well to both John D and Matthew Katusiak, who I ran into down at Oz Comic Con.
Hi, John.
Hi, Matt and John. Great hanging out with you guys over the weekend. Great to see you. Great to put a face to some of the our listeners, because we don't often.
We sit in a little box.
Exactly. I got papped. Matt asked, said, "Can I take a photo with you?"
My God!
And I wasn't even in costume.
Nobody ever does that to me.
Some of the things that people have asked us to have a read of. Steve Clark says, "I'm going to keep requesting Johnny the Homicidal Maniac until you cave in and read it.
Okay. Just keep hammering on that one.
the aforementioned Matthew said anything that features Deadpool. So I think we do have to do a Deadpool.
We do need to do a Deadpool.
I'd like to start with like the Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, those kind of ones maybe.
Yeah, well, actually that might make a nice bookend too, because we did Punisher Kills the Marvel
That's
Universe.
That's true.
So. Have you seen he's got a new one out called Deadpool Kills Deadpool?
It went Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, Deadpool Kills Deadpool Killustrated, which we killed a whole lot of classic historical and literature. Figures from literature.
Yeah.
And now Deadpool Kills Deadpool. He's got to go. and finally, Quiver, John D says, Quiver, Guardian, Devil, which is a Daredevil book. Oh, Killing Joke, definitely.
Killing Joke's been on our list for a long time. I don't know what...
And he says, all guest starring that guy from In the Wilderness. So, yes, John, we'll probably have to get you on the show at some stage. So, yes, definitely look out for those things. While you're looking for those things, go to behindthepanels.net and buy some stuff, because we talked about needing money to go off on our Comic-Con crawl next year. Go and buy some t-shirts. Go and buy some badges.
Badges, mugs.
Stickers.
And if there's something you want us to put on a t-shirt, make a request.
Yes.
We'll create it for you.
If there's a quote you hear in one of these shows, if you want read between the lines, bitch, on a t-shirt,
we'll put it on a t-shirt
for you. We'll just go ahead. The song's ended, so I'm going to stop talking now.
Our studio audience is pointing something
badly. He's pointing at Ultimate Spider-Man, but I'm not sure what he wants me to do with it.
It's Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh, he wants me to do Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh, he's saying he wants Ultimate Spider-Man.
Right.
Read the lines, bitch.
I didn't read between the lines, bitch, on that one. I didn't connect the dots between behind the lines there. Yes, Ultimate Spider-Man is like certainly the first few arcs of that. This is the original Ultimate Spider-Man back in 2001, I think. Excellent stuff. Nicholas has been reading that.
I'm just bringing up Nicholas's microphone here. Nicholas, tell us what it is about Ultimate Spider-Man that you want.
What?
Well, I mean, you're pointing at it furiously. Why is this?
Because I want you guys to do it on the show.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Goodbye.
No, it is good. I read it back in its original form, and it's really good. So it's a great different version.
And this is not the Miles Morales.
No,
we're
no.
talking about the original Ultimate Spider-Man.
Whatever. They were given a sandbox to play in. Speaking of sandboxes to play in, David, it is time for us to hit up this button.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
He's the best there is at what he does. And what he does is pretty awesome. Chris Claremont was 7 years into his X-Men run and just hitting his stride. At the height of its popularity, he not only launched New Mutants, but two of the most defining X-Men stories of all time. Wolverine with Frank Miller and God Loves, Man Kills. This is Claremont 82.
It's a very impressive voice you have there.
I don't know what you're talking about, David. We've actually found a bit of information about that voice. We might have a different voice appearing there soon, but more on that later.
We won't tease unless we actually have it.
We actually have it, exactly right. But yes, as that voice said, we're doing two books this week. We're doing Wolverine, which is more or less it's the four-issue miniseries that came out in 1982.
I suppose we should clarify something before we go any further.
Yes.
There are people who are going to be saying, why aren't we doing the list right now? Because in the last show,
oh, yes,
we said we were going to do the list, and suddenly we're doing Wolverine. We have a Wolverine movie about to come out
next week.
And we thought we better cover that. And then we thought, well, the timing lines up beautifully because we'll do a Wolverine special on that. So we thought, let's do the classic Wolverine miniseries because this is what the film is based on. And then next week we're doing the Wolverine movie.
And then we'll do the list. Because we definitely want to come back to the list because Paul Bedford is an awesome man.
Absolutely.
Also ran into him at Oz Comic Con.
He's a great guy. Look, he's a great guy, and I've read half of the list already.
Yeah.
And my God, it's disturbed.
It's dark. It's very dark. But a little bit lighter is not too much lighter.
No, it's not too much lighter at all.
It gets into some darker territory. Is Wolverine, which is, as I said, a four-issue miniseries. But also, you really have to take it, you have to read it together with Uncanny X-Men 172 and 173.
Yeah, which so it's kind of a six-issue miniseries, really.
And David, you were saying this before the show, is at this stage, Claremont's X-Men universe was so finely integrated that you couldn't separate the pieces. Now, to put this into historical context, I said this was 7 years into Claremont's run. But now, there's about 13, 14, 15 X-Men titles out there. At this time, at the start of 1982, there was one. There was X-Men, which became Uncanny X-Men.
Actually, I think it was already
Uncanny. It was already Uncanny X-Men by this stage. Yeah. There was one book, and in many ways, Claremont says this in the Supernova special, which is the first part of this interview, how he wanted to keep that pure in some respects, and if it was going to split off, he wanted to do that. Mm. And that was New Mutants, which started as a graphic novel in that year. Also, or maybe the year before, and then became an ongoing series. But he also did this other ongoing series, or limited series rather, Wolverine, this year. So let's listen to what Chris had to say about...
Chris, nice of you to join us in the studio. No.
Chris, could you tell us a little bit about how Frank Miller's success... I won't pretend that he's here. here he talks a little bit about Frank Miller's success on Daredevil already, what that meant, His success before he hit up things like Dark Knight Returns, of course, and how the two of them working together came about and what that meant for Marvel.
The view at Marvel and of success at Marvel versus success at DC were two wholly different things. I mean, Frank and I were basically dueling continuously over which one of us would be top of the sales charts for about 3 or 4 years before he went over there. But, you know, the idea with Wolverine, or as the film is called, The Wolverine, is that it put together, well, I put together the two top talents in Marvel, which we like to think at the time meant the industry, and see what we could come up with. And I spent 3.5 hours pitching him as we drove from San Diego to Los Angeles up Interstate 5 after the San Diego Comic-Con, and he thought that was cool.
And it was pretty cool. This book starts off with the classic line, I'm the best there is at what I do, and what I do isn't very nice.
Yeah.
Which is everything that you ever need to say about Wolverine.
Now, I have to start this entire review with
retraction.
With a retraction. And it's because I'm sure there are listeners right now who are throwing things at their... No, they can't throw things at your iPod, can you? But anyway...
You could, but it'd be awkward. You could throw your iPod.
You could throw your iPod away. Basically saying, David, you hypocrite.
I've been saying that for ages.
Okay, so if you go back many weeks ago, in our What We've Been Reading section, I actually said I picked up Frank Miller, Chris Claremont's Wolverine, and I said it didn't hold up. And I said that I was kind of disappointed because I remember really liking it, and it didn't kind of hold up. However, since that time, we've gone into Chris Claremont world, and we read dozens and dozens of X-Men comics, and we really got back into the rhythm of that 1970s, 1980s comic book, that dense, rich Claremont world.
It's a very groovy mutation.
It's a very groovy mutation. And I found myself, when I picked up Wolverine this morning, actually, to reread the 4 issues, I found myself totally engrossed in it, which I wasn't last time. And I think it's because I was suddenly back in that world again.
And there is a very different beat, very different, definite vibe to it. This is a book that starts off with that immortal line, but also with Wolverine in the Canadian Rockies fighting a bear.
Yeah, and it's a great setup because it says in those 3 pages, I think it is, or 4 pages, it says everything about that is about to come.
And we should say, like, from the beginning of this, even though this is very different art style to what you're used to seeing from Frank Miller now, his layout in this is actually magnificent. There's pages where it's a white background, and it's almost as though the bear and Wolverine have burst out of the panel, and that it's hovering mid page. You know, there's later things. You know, when Mariko is introduced later on, they reintroduce, because she's already been in the main X-Men title. There's just this one-page kind of sketch drawing of her, which is just that little bit different. Like, it's sort of like to convey how beautiful Wolverine finds her, you know?
It's really interesting coming back to Mariko, or Mariko, I think it is, but we actually introduced her way back at the beginning. If you remember when we did that epic run of X-Men, she was introduced in that, where he first met her. And so it's interesting to come back to that now, which is what we're talking, at least another 3 years down the track from where we left off, you know, or 2 years from where we left off.
And both, I mean, look, they've said that this was an opportunity to explore Wolverine's Japanese origins, because when she was introduced, Wolverine spoke fluent Japanese, and it had been clear that he'd spent a lot of time in Japan. And while we don't go into that in this, you know, what exactly his history was, we get a sense of that, how much of the culture he was involved in, how much he knew about it. He is, when he goes to Japan, he wants basically his intention is to marry her.
Yeah.
But he can't because she's already married to somebody else.
And it's amazing the amount of research that Claremont and Miller have actually done in this book, because their details on things like the weaponry being used, the culture, the sense of honor, those little splashes of Japanese that they throw in there.
Yes.
They obviously knew their crap, you know what I mean?
And at a time when they didn't necessarily have to.
No.
You know, and this is the thing about both Claremont and Miller, they elevated funny books to a high level.
Mm-hmm.
Made them something...
They made them adult.
They made them adult. That's exactly what they did. And this is what Claremont 82 really is all about. He was not only starting... this is effectively a graphic novel split over four issues.
Yes. If it was released today, it would have been a graphic novel.
But he also... Actually, no, they'd probably milk it for the four issues. but he was releasing graphic novels at this time. Two graphic novels at least that year with New Mutants and God Loves, Man Kills.
Yeah.
Either one of those would be a significant work. Or any of these three would be a significant work. In addition to working on... some of the best run of Uncanny X-Men.
Well, you've got
12
issues of Uncanny X-Men in the same year. So yeah. You got 12 issues of that. You've got four issues of this. You've got two full
novels. No, I think it was coming out more frequently than that.
No, I think it was still once a month. At this point. So it's an extraordinary body of work. I mean, the thing about Claremont, and we said this when we've talked to him, and we said this during our run of X, the man was dedicated, and he knew his world so well that he could split it off into all these splinter books. And he actually talks about in that Supernova special part of the interview where he basically says if they were going to split this off into other X-Men books, he wanted to be part of it because it was his world, you know?
Yeah. This is... I mean, Wolverine's everywhere now. I mean, if you go into the shops at the moment, you've got Savage Wolverine, Wolverine and the X-Men, Wolverine, Wolverine in the Flesh this month, Wolverine Max, and there was a recently, and he's in a bunch of X-Men and Avengers titles.
Yeah.
He's everywhere. But this was the height of, this is the beginning of the height of his popularity. Yeah. But what this book did was actually showcase Wolverine as a fragile human, as well as the Beast. There are a few moments in this where he goes berserker, and Mariko sees him for the first time.
Well, yeah, and when we talk about the two extra issues that you read as a companion to this,
with Kitty, yeah,
Kitty sees him as a berserker for the first time, and he actually there's that thought where I really didn't ever want her to see this side of me, you know.
Yeah. Well, taken together, we should say all those issues form what's called the Japan Saga, basically. So it's these four issues plus X-Men 172 and 173.
And we're not really going to dwell on X-Men 172.
If you buy the trade paperback collection, not the version we've got, which is the beautiful Ultimate Graphic Novels collection, and the reproduction is wonderful in this.
Oh, it's amazing.
not this version of it, but if you buy the current trade paperback, it comes with those two issues.
Oh, there
so
you go.
You're sorted. But of course, there is a lot of stuff you've missed, like Rogue joining the X-Men and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just suddenly, and you know, something's happened to Carol Danvers in there as well, and all
and there's
this
that
sort of
mistrust
stuff.
Between Wolverine because he's been away.
Yes,
with Rogue,
and we should say, yeah, Wolverine is away from the X-Men at this stage.
Yeah.
And what this does is, as I said, create him as a fragile human and sort of tames a savage beast. Like, this is the closest Wolverine gets to being happy.
Hmm.
And I think we know
almost.
That almost happy. One of the things is the beautiful layouts, as I said, by Frank Miller. I'm just going to hold up a page and show David a scene where Yuriko, isn't it?
Yukio.
Is dancing, or not dancing, but fighting, dancing in a poetic sense across the rooftops, against the background of these billboards, and the way Miller's just laid this out, it's all stark, you know, two or three colors,
mm-hmm.
and that is the birth of the modern Frank Miller.
That's the birth of Sin City,
right there. You know, it looks like a Sin City layout right there. This is. Magnificent book.
Also, Miller is not afraid to do portraits. He's not afraid to do, in the terms of movie making, he's not afraid to do the close-up.
No.
And there are the mini shots in this where he'll take up a half a page with a portrait.
Exactly
with
right.
With thought balloons around it, like, here I am thinking, this is my reaction. And we get to see all that detail in those reactions.
And I should say that this book is told from the perspective of Wolverine.
Yeah.
It's a first-person narrative, which is interesting. He carries that narrative over into those two extra X-Men issues as well,
mm-hmm.
which puts them apart from the rest of the X-Men books as well. It becomes,
almost like
Wolverine's
this was supposed
book.
To be part of the X-Men books, and then he went, oh, well, there's no other X-Men in it, so I better move them off.
Yeah,
obviously
this was a story he was compelled to tell. And as he said in that little interview clip, with the two top, what he saw, and without any false modesty, because he deserves it, he saw himself and Frank Miller as the two top Marvel talents.
And they kind of were at that time.
At 1982, absolutely right. Now, what he does also talk to us about is what Wolverine became as a result of this. And I asked him in the interview where he thought the character... Because when we last spoke to him, he actually said he was disappointed in the direction that Wolverine...
And he actually said if he'd had a choice to kill off another character, it would have been
Wolverine. So I sort of followed that up in this interview, given that this ultimately leads us into the birth of the Wolverine ongoing and the industry unto itself that Wolverine is.
Mm. Last time you spoke about you didn't like the way that Wolverine ultimately became magical, and that was sort of after your real run in a lot of ways. Well, but during your time, did the character of Wolverine... How did you picture him evolving during the long run that you had on him?
He evolved into what he is, which was the cornerstone of the team. What happens, every writer has to accept, whether they like it or not, the reality that what happens after you leave a title is out of your control. Sometimes what happens while you're writing the book is out of your control. If you want a measure of control, what you need to do is write and publish your own work, your own creations. That was why I was so happy when the gentleman brought up Alien Predator, because one of the deals that I cut when I did the series was Alien is a wholly owned creation of, I forget which studio. Predator is a wholly owned creation of the studio. I figured if they've got their wholly owned creations, I need one of mine.
So, yeah, I mean, that's... He went into a little bit about another book there, and there's a little bit more about that in the interview, but there's only another 30 seconds worth of stuff that I haven't played there. But he makes a very good point that these were his babies. He effectively made them. He didn't create Wolverine, but he made Wolverine what he is.
Yeah. Well, he said in his last interview he had a hand in the creation of Wolverine.
That's true. Because he was involved in a lot of the plotting.
Of the giant size. He didn't actually write the giant
Wolverine
size.
Wolverine was introduced before that, but then he was Alpha Flight and there's all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. But he was a secondary character. Nobody knew who Wolverine was until they turned him into an X-Man.
But, you know, he makes a very good point. Look, Wolverine, reading this book, you can see why Wolverine is... you know, the king of the X-Men. You know, why everyone loves Wolverine. I mean, like, he's a cool character. Mm. But the combination of the Japanese code of honor, the beautiful layouts...
It fits Logan so well. Yeah. That whole... Even the fact that his claws are drawn like little samurai swords. Yes. You know, everything about him...
And that's Miller. You can see Miller's Japanese influences.
Because if you actually look at early Wolverine, his claws were spikier.
Yes.
And then by the time we get to Miller, we're actually introducing the fact that they're coming out between the knuckles. We're actually seeing the samurai sword shape of them. Mm. And this is all informed how Wolverine has gone
and
on it, to
And
look.
It's amazing how well he fits. Because you know, they got him in traditional Japanese garb as well. Mm. How well it fits. The only time this feels like a Claremont... sort of some of that tweeness that Claremont sort of occasionally indulges in is the last couple of pages when he sends the wedding invite to the X-Men, and then it becomes an old X-Men story again, which is kind of where it segues into the two X-Men issues. But literally the last panel of issue 4 of this
is the cover
of 172.
And it's very interesting. You have to, in context with the movie that's coming out, you have to actually look at 72 and 73, or 172 and 173, because Silver Samurai and Viper are two of the main characters in the movie. They're actually not in the Wolverine miniseries. They're actually from that episode, their issues 172 and 173 of X-Men.
They undoubtedly made their own story, but they've drawn it from those six issues.
Yes.
So, David, we should now talk a little bit about God Loves, Man Kills, which... Mm. I think Claremont says it best himself in this clip, what the book represents to X-Men.
If I wanted to encapsulate the X-Men in one format, one story, that would be it. And the problem was, I was too smart for my own good. I used up all of my essential ideas in one story. I mean, that was, to me, the quintessential X-Men. Therefore, there was no need to do another one, which is very frustrating. And there was no need to do a longer story. I did tons of longer stories or long story formats. It's just that a graphic novel, a specific standalone story that could be read and enjoyed on its own terms, it's a rare thing. You want it to be absolutely special.
He's absolutely right. I mean, this is the definitive X-Men.
This is... I read this, and I talk about this in the next clip that I'll play in a moment, but reading this now, this is still so fresh. This is basically the basis for X-Men 2, give or take. The idea that...
it's kind of the basis of the entire movie series, actually.
Yes.
It's like for the trilogy of films that they made, they kind of went, this is what we're coming from.
Because this is effectively what modern X-Men draws all of its power from. The idea that if there is a group of people who are different and there's another group of people who fear them, there will be these right-wing groups. The Stryker character in this and the whole idea of that evangelical preacher was a very, very, very real character.
Mm.
He mentions in the next clip the 700 Club, and that's what's his name? He forgot it at the time too. Those evangelicals who were around, later became people like Billy Graham, Pat Robertson.
Oh, Pat Robertson, yeah, of course.
Evangelicals like that. And I actually asked him at the time what he thought of, where did he draw his inspiration from? Were there particular people that he was looking at? And this is what he had to say.
So God Loves, Man Kills is the graphic novel we're talking about. And it's I read it again yesterday and it still seems really fresh. And it's still very analogous to a lot of civil rights movements that are still happening, in particular gay rights. But back in the early 80s when you were writing it, were there particular figures that you had in mind when you were writing those two main antagonists?
Well, I did a lot of research prior to writing it. Watching evangelical preachers on TV, watching them in reality, looking at the social and political scene in the United States at the time. The whole point was to present as rational and relevant a story as possible, that where both sides believe they were the good guys. I mean, the whole point of Stryker was that he's not a villain. He doesn't consider himself a villain. That he considers himself as valid and legitimate a hero and patriot as can be, because he is fighting what he thinks is a threat to the United States and to humanity.
Do you worry at all about, or did you even cop any flack from conservative groups or evangelicals at the time?
Well, actually, what's-his-face who runs the 700 Club actually held up an issue on the air and held up a copy of on the air and said it was a tool for Satan.
And was it?
I figure it was the best promotion one could get.
I love that. And he's right. I mean, that still happens today, with right-wing conservative groups holding up
what they disagree with,
a video game, a film or a book or a magazine, and saying, this is a tool of Satan. And, we saw it with the Archie comics,
absolutely.
The Million Moms groups, and so forth. I mean, this is one of the boldest comics because it is still so fresh. And the reason it's so fresh is because it was so bold in 82. It's still bold now.
Now, I actually wanted to read one panel, or a couple of panels from it, because when I reread this book, it had as much impact today as it had then. In fact, in some ways, much more impact. Now, I want to put a disclaimer out there right now that I am quoting from the book.
And in fact, the clip I'll play next also quotes from the book. Okay, so the language in there is a direct quote.
It is not my language. It is the book's language. But in the book, Kitty Pryde is basically being picked on because she's a mutant. And this whole book really comes down to it. It's all about bigotry. And she's at her dance class, and her dance teacher is an African-American. And she says the teacher has broken up the fight. And basically she says, how can you all be so calm? Didn't you hear what he said? Because he basically called her a mutie. And the dance teacher says, they're only words, child. And Kitty Pryde says to the dance teacher, suppose he'd called me a nigger lover, Stevie. Would you be so damn tolerant then? Where the power of this comes from is not just that line, which actually made me stop reading for a second. Yeah. I actually kind of went, whoa, I can't believe he put that in there to start with. But there's also the next page where Stevie is standing there watching them leave. A tear rolls down her eye and she goes, one of the other students says, she didn't mean it. And in her thought bubble, she says, of course she did, my friend. She meant every word and she was right.
Mm.
And that has so much power today. Mm. It's more power, I think, because that word has even more power today.
Yes.
Of the way that it is being played around with, that we can really, when you read this, you sit there and go, whoa, I can't believe he did that.
And I asked Chris about that power and about whether or not that kind of frankness had a place in modern comics. And this is what he had to say. It's a wonderful answer.
There are certain concepts and certain conversations I have, and I'm thinking in particular of a conversation at the start of the of God Loves, Man Kills, where I think one of the characters actually says, would you react the same way if they'd been calling me a nigger lover, for example?
Oh, he says that to Stevie.
That's right. Do you think that's something that that kind of frankness still has a place in modern comics?
To me, that sort of frankness is far more appropriate to storytelling in a mass market comic book sense than gratuitous profanity and bare breasts.
Agreed.
Any idiot can do a story about, you know, flashing about characters being sexually adventurous. Big deal. I mean, it's the trick is to find a way to do a story that transcends the beliefs and cliches about the medium, but also more importantly remains as valid and important, in my case, 30 years later, as it was. The point is, you want stories to be memorable, and you want them to be memorable for the right reason. For me, I want a story that when I read it, I want to read it again. I want to tell friends about it. I want it to be important to them, much as I would with a book. Or a classic movie, you know. Otherwise, what's the point?
So do we, Chris.
Couldn't say it better ourselves. And in fact, I think that's a wonderful way to finish talking about that book because Chris, I couldn't say anything better than the way Chris talked about his own book there. This is, if you're going to read one X-Men book in your life, this is the book you read.
Absolutely. And if you're going to read two, you follow it up with Wolverine.
Agreed. This has been a wonderful experience getting to talk to Chris Claremont twice, and we might even get to do it again. So
now, I just want to, just for those who are going, oh, you kind of short-shrifted God Loves, Man Kills because of Wolverine. Wolverine was the focus of the episode. Mm. We kind of threw in the other book because it was the same year, et cetera, et cetera. And we did have the Chris Claremont interview put in there. So it was worth talking about. And one day we may come back and revisit this book because this book is actually one that we could go through in detail, by panel.
We'll definitely go through it in detail. But we wanted, basically, it was around the interview.
Yeah.
David, that is all we have time for this week. But you can still find us online. You can find you, sir, where?
Find me at geekactually.com or on Twitter at David McVeigh.
You can find me online on Twitter at DVDBits. You can find me at behindthepanels.net. You can also find me at therealbits.com and occasionally at newsarama.com as well. If you've got any feedback, anything you want to say to us, send us an email at feedback@behindthepanels.net. Hit us up on facebook.com/behindthepanels. Or you can leave us a Skype voice message at Geek Actually.
If you don't need an invite or anything, just call it in and you'll leave a voicemail.
And if you want to support us, obviously money's great, but the best way to support
<Money's great. laughs>
the best way to support us is to leave us positive feedback on iTunes. That'll help us achieve everything we want and more. The next week's pick is, of course, we go to the movies again. We're going to see The Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
That will be based on the book that we've been speaking about this week. David, anything else to add?
I just wanted to add very quickly, for those who are local, that is in Sydney in particular, but if you're in Australia, our Skype ID also has a phone number attached to it. So if it's easier for you to call, so if you want to just pick up a phone and dial 02-8011-4167, and you can leave us a voicemail there as well. So we'd love to hear your voices, play them on the show. So. Especially your opinions on The Wolverine, considering that we're going to be doing the show a couple of days after its release. So if you see it, drop a voicemail about your opinions on it, and we'll play them on that show.
And if you're leaving a message, until then, I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
And this is Behind the Panels.